Hello and welcome to the Majlis Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. A couple of days ago, the European Parliament has released a rare and somewhat strong-worded pointed statement criticizing the recent crackdown against members of civil society in Kazakhstan. The statement particularly notes that the growing pressure and penalization of human rights NGOs, press freedom advocates, and civil society activists by local authorities. Of course, as Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, with a large presence on the ground, we don't have to look further to understand the point that the statement was trying to make, as our own colleagues are going through this. But on today's Majlis podcast, we have invited members of civil societies to discuss what is going on, how the growing pressure looks like on the ground, how it is affecting their work, more importantly, what can be done about it. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Yevgeny Zhovtis, the director of Kazakhstan International Bureau for Human Rights and Rule of Law. Yevgeny is joining us from Almaty, Kazakhstan. Marius Fossum, regional representative in Central Asia for the Norwegian Helsinki Committee. Marius is also joining us from Almaty, Kazakhstan. Aygerim Tolyukhanova, senior Kazakh journalist with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Kazakh service, locally known as Radio Azatik. Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you very much, colleagues, for joining us today. So, Yevgeny, let me start with you. If I'm not mistaken, your NGO was also one of those which were targeted in recent days, I guess. So what happened?
Yes, this moment, the charges were dropped by the city tax department. We are still with some cases in courts. There are still trials underway. We are expecting next week or the week after. But at this point, there is no imminent threat for fines or suspension of activities.
So what was your assessment of what they were trying to do here?
It looked like there were several factors which are making their input in all this story. First of all, of course, I think that they want to check the foreign funding for the NGOs in Kazakhstan, because more than 20 NGOs were involved. They tried to look where this foreign funding is channeling to, whether it is channeled to the opposition or protesters or some other people. They want to check that because of the coming elections. The parliament election took place in January, on 10th of January, and in November, December, they tried to look into this foreign funding. Secondly, of course, is the events in Belarus and Russia, because they think that all these events and all this certain kind of uprising are supported by such NGOs as ours, and that they are supported through the foreign funding. And finally, they are looking to the growing, let's say, so protest activity. More and more people are raising their voices. More and more activism is inside the social networks. All these together bring them to the need to crack down on the most prominent and most outspoken human rights organizations dealing with this political rights and civil freedoms.
Interesting. Yevgeny's NGO, Marius, I'm coming to you. Yevgeny's NGO is not the only one going through this lately. What about the other NGOs? Please tell us the nature of the pressure and how those pressures are ending up or ended up.
In short, as Yevgeny Alexandrovich already said, the regime had tax authorities go after like several leading human rights groups on the basis of alleged minor violations, such as violations of reporting procedures on like funding, like really just minor issues and really just formalities. And then they fined the groups and motioned to have their activities suspended, initially for just a 3-month period, which would be bad enough in and of itself. But who knows what they had in mind for the long run?
What's your assessment?
Well, it's hard to say, and it's hard to say why they did this and why they did this just now. But I also think, I don't know if Yevgeny Alexandrovich will agree with this or not, but I also think it very well may have been a preparation of sorts for a wider crackdown. You know, in the event, however unlikely at the moment, but nonetheless, that Kazakhstan would see protests over the elections gain momentum over time and kind of evolve into a mass movement aspiring to challenge the elections or even the regime itself, you know, similar to what's going on in Belarus and also recently in Russia. I don't think this is a very likely scenario at the moment, at least. But, you know, the state certainly fears it. And they're watching what's going on in Belarus. And with the country's human rights community disabled, their activities suspended, it would just be so much easier for authorities to crack down on and contain mass protests. As there would be no human rights defenders, say, getting in their way. There would be no one to provide legal aid to the thousands that authorities would have to detain in order to contain such protests. I would not be very surprised if authorities were thinking also along these lines when deciding to go after human rights NGOs.
Interesting. Of course, we are going to talk about this big picture politics behind their actions and reactions. Before that, feel free to both Marius and Yevgeny to jump in. You know, it looks like to me so far from both of your comments, pretext that they are using, the authorities are using to put pressure on NGOs seems to be tax related. Is it the way we should understand it? There is nothing else that they are bringing up?
The problem is that it's not about the taxes at all. They're using the legislation which was introduced in 2016 about the reporting about foreign funding. It's typical informational forms you have to fill in and to provide to the tax inspections because they are responsible for these forms to be treated. And as a result of that, this is absolute informational forms which they use as a pretext with some kind of minor discrepancies or something like that. There is no any evasion, there is no any crime, there is no money spending for the wrong purposes. And it's not about the taxes at all. That's it's only the reason to go after. And I agree with Marius that they are looking for these human rights organizations because they have already cracked down on civic activists and some political groups. And they are looking to any institutionalized civil society organizations which are providing certain legal aid or providing information or raising the issue of political prisoners. And because of all these events in Belarus and Russia, they think that it should be put under control. They should be frightened in certain way. They should be signaled that the authorities could do anything they want. And they use absolutely minor things to bring it to the level of possible suspension or heavy fines.
Any NGO so far being suspended? I mean, in your case, the case was dropped. And I guess your NGO is back in action, right? I mean, are there any other NGOs whose activities were suspended because of recent crackdown or something?
There were three organizations which activities were suspended and fined, including mine. And all the charges against all of them were dropped. But it was clearly at the same day, on 4th of February. But it was clearly because of the international pressure, because of some kind of different attention, and even this some kind of tweets from the U.S. Embassy, right. Statement from the spokesperson of the European Union. Probably it related to this kind of stepping back.
Right. Right. You know, I'm sure we are going to skip so many names today, but since it is close to home, let me also draw, Igrim, your attention to two other NGOs, which were apparently the target. They are, I guess, one is called MediaNet, and the other is Media Center. They were also summoned, along with Yevgeny's NGO in recent days. Anything came out from those cases?
As far as I know, in one day, authorities dropped most of the cases against a dozen of NGOs that were working in the field of human rights and monitoring of elections and preparing different reports on these activities. So right now, I think it's, I'm not really sure, but I think it's just that the cases are dropped and NGOs are not really sure what they can continue to do, what is allowed to do. And I think that's what authorities actually try to achieve with their actions. They wanted to scare these NGOs and activists so that they won't be too outspoken next time because they fear that more and more people noticing many changes in society and they want to put like a iron fist on it.
On press freedom, you know, I was looking into Human Rights Watch's report, which was recently released, and there was also mention of press and independent media there. So, Igrim, you guys have dozens of local reporters on the ground. How they and you have been feeling this pressure?
Of course, many independent journalists, they do feel a lot of pressure, especially if their organization does not have a lot of resources, such as lawyers or certain kind of legal advices from media lawyers, and also just a regular physical protection. And I've seen many of Azatlık journalists were constantly harassed and monitored and even detained. But regarding the recent case, you mentioned MediaNet, they actually have raised some concerns because they have their own project called factcheck.kz. Because they were told to suspend their activities, they were also fearing that their project will be finished, because you cannot obviously suspend a media project for 3 months. The whole audience will be gone already to other media sources. So I think that it would be a very serious case if they would have to close this media source, because it's really important to fact check different political statements of politicians in Kazakhstan and deputies, and also different crazy conspiracy theories that became rampant during the pandemic and before the pandemic. And they actually do a lot of great work on that.
Right. Bruce, let me bring you in here. It looks like over the past 1 or 2 months has been the toughest for the NGOs, civil society activists. But were there any sign that it was coming to this conclusion, coming to this destruction?
Well, I suppose you had to assume that they were going to do something ahead of elections. I mean, let's face it, since Nazarbayev stepped down and Tokayev came to power, there's always been a problem with protests or demonstrations. And they have addressed this, you know, in the run-up to presidential elections, when opposition groups, specifically a Blazov's group, will call for demonstrations or something, they'll go out and detain activists ahead of the date. So they've been not rehearsing. I mean, this is actually just part of their whole policy now, is to try to cut these things off in advance. So it was always the signs that something like this was going to happen.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce. You know, it's very interesting the way you put this. Also, our friend Mira Rittman of Human Rights Watch, she couldn't join us today, but in her recent report, she was particularly concerned about the latest attacks on the freedom of associations in Kazakhstan, and the size and the scope of harassment and the way in which the authorities are carrying out their actions so bluntly. So what stands out in all these? I kind of opened the lid for a big question here. Maybe I should take a short break and then continue the conversation about these actions and some of the possible long and short-term implications of latest developments. So yes, let's continue the debate in those lines very shortly. First, let me recap the debate today on the Majlis podcast. I'm joined by Yevgeny Zhevtis, the director of the Kazakhstan International Bureau for Human Rights and Rule of Law, Marius Fossum, regional representative in Central Asia for the Norwegian Helsinki Committee, Aigerim Tolyukhanova, senior Kazakh journalist with Radio Free Pride Liberty's Kazakh service, locally known as Radio Azatik, Bruce Fanier, the editor of Radio Free Pride Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Pride Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. And we are discussing the latest wave of crackdown against civil society and NGOs in Kazakhstan. Why not, Bruce, I will start with you again here. So we heard both Aigrim and Marius and Yevgeny. So when you look into the list of NGOs that are being targeted, what are the commonalities among the NGOs who are targeted, and what does that tell you?
Well, I think, as we've heard, you know, they've been cracking down on civil society for a while. And right. So, you know, who could help opposition groups? Who could actually be like the basis for an opposition, an organized opposition in the future? And you know, they've narrowed down the field so much that this was just one group, I think, that they realized they hadn't really dealt with them yet.
But does the timing tell us anything?
Opposition parties that are registered. You know, and now they have all these new groups springing up that they're trying to deal with, you know, again, after Nazarbayev stepped down, there's challenges they haven't seen in a long time that are coming up, people questioning decisions of leadership and who's in the leadership itself, you know, so they're looking for anyone who could possibly give more oxygen to the grumblings of the people who are unsatisfied with the way the situation is evolving right now.
Earlier, Yevgeny was talking about, Bruce, in terms of the timing, referring to elections or something. Does the timing tell you anything behind these crackdowns? I mean, what the objectives might be?
clearly that was it. They understood that elections would be one time when they could see a lot of pushback from you know, just even simple ordinary citizens, civil society, different groups who, you know, again, challenge the government's narrative regularly. And so they were, you know, trying to head that off. It's pretty clear that there's a section, you know, of society that's just not happy with the way the political situation is panning out. You know, there was a lot of hopes that when Nazarbayev stepped down, you know, certainly years before he actually did step down, there was hopes that when he did go, it would be a big change. And then he kind of half went, not even half went. I mean, he's still there. So, you know, people saw that now there was a leadership change and that they'd been waiting for years, but then it really wasn't a leadership change at all. You know, it's kind of like a trick. So, of course, there's a lot of disappointment and a lot of anger about the way things are going. Tokayev has paid lip service to the idea that I'm going to implement reforms, I'm going to change, but he doesn't really appear to be actually in power. And so nothing is changing. So you had a change in leadership that didn't lead to any change in society at all. So there's, you know, there's a lot of discontent out there. And anyone who can explain to people that they're right to be unhappy with the situation, why legally they're right to be unhappy with the situation, why, you know, in moral terms, they're right to be unhappy with the situation is perceived as a threat by the authorities.
I agree. I wondered your thought on that. I mean, the other point that the Human Rights Watch report was kind of raising is, you know, they were shocked about the scale of this crackdown. And is there anything that we don't know which is driving these actions by the authorities?
Yeah, I actually interviewed Mira Rittman, who is unable to join us today. I interviewed her for the article for Azadlyk. Actually, she told me that it seems very kind of suspicious that so many organizations were targeted at the same time. It was over a dozen, at least 13 organizations were targeted with this tax report. And she gave a very good picture, legal framework of different laws that have been adopted, amended, or accepted after certain events, which in a bigger picture give the impression that there is a kind of constant crackdown on the freedom of association in Kazakhstan. And indeed, we can notice that despite the political kind of demand from the people that they want their constitutional right to protest and to register political parties and do other political activities, authorities are becoming more nervous because they know that if they give maybe just a little bit of opportunity to do that, people will demand even more and more, and probably that's not a good thing for them. And I see that in general, as Bruce rightly mentioned, there is a growing discontent in society. And I don't know, maybe at some point there will be such a big discontent that there will be something more than just a protest of several dozens of people. But I'm not really sure it will happen very soon because most of the people are still very passive. They think about how to provide for their families, how to survive the winter without heating or how to get water. And they still don't make this connection that these conditions, their living conditions, are connected to politics. And when they do that, probably something will change.
Interesting. Earlier, Yevgeny, you were trying to explain some background information as to how these things has started and what might be driving authorities to take such actions. From your perspective, why the authorities are doing this and also why they are doing it such bluntly as the Human Rights Watch reports puts it?
First of all, I want to add something to what Bruce said, and I agree that it was not 13 organizations. According to my assessment, it's more than 20, and some of them were not so prominent or so well known. That there is certain commonalities between the among these organizations. Practically all of these organizations get certain funding from either Soros structures or National Endowment for Democracy or from the USAID. It means that it looks like they consider this funding from U.S. or from U.S.-based organizations, keeping in mind their conspirological theories and their experience looking at Ukraine, I don't know, at Belarus, at Russia, they see this funding as a threat. And that's, they want to check where this funding is going to, and trying to look at that, because I have a lot of meetings with the U.S. embassy here and with the, and some people from USAID, which we are very concerned about such kind of very clear link between their funding and the attack on these civil society organizations.
Yevgeny, is it your own assessment that they are targeting those organizations which are getting some sort of funding from the U.S.-based organization, or the authorities clearly say that this is the case?
They did not say that, but it was clear that most of these organizations I was talking to and which were exposed to this type of examination and then pressure, practically all of them were the grantees of either National Endowment for Democracy or OSF, Open Society Foundations, or getting some funding from USAID. And second, it was clear, look, Belarus, how Lukashenko cracked down on the Belarusian NGOs, our friends from Human Rights Community, Human Rights Center Vyazna, and some others. It looks like they're cooperating, communicating, exchanging experience between each other, Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, all together in the certain union. And it looks like they are trying to keep the full control as possible because of what Aygerim said, because of this growing discontent, because of they're afraid of possible developments, growing social economical problems, growing social disparity, lack of justice, and so on. And this, it is growing. They are looking at the organization which has certain mobilizing or financial capabilities to support in either way or from point of view of the government unloyal or providing information for the foreign sources, for the European Parliament, for the international media and so on. And all this together is the driving force for them. And as a result of that, and one important point is that there is still these two centers of power, Nazarbayev, who keep his conservative views and who tries to be as safe as possible. They try to avoid any risks for themselves and for their wealth and so on. And modernizers around Tokayev, they are in the limited political corridor and have not so much to do and rather weak.
Yeah, that was the point earlier I was trying to explain, Bruce, in our private conversation. You know, who appears to be behind these actions? You know, it's a kind of political question. Kazakhstani government become a little complicated for me to understand, at least looking into the situation from 10,000 feet above. So Nazarbayev is doing his own thing behind the curtain now, since that he's not a president. And now we have a President Tokayev. I mean, who appears to be doing all these, and who appears to be the beneficiary out of this situation?
From my point of view, let's put this way, and according to my information, behind this there were some people from the presidential administration, but including some people from the Security Council and from the Committee on National Security. And they provide very clear instructions to the Ministry of Finance, the Committee on State Revenues, Tax Committee, which conducted this examination themselves. And then they sent these results to the local tax bodies to already start the procedure for fining or for suspension. It was inside these four structures, namely politically some part of the presidential administration of Mr. Tokayev, partly the Security Council, which is led by Mr. Nazarbayev, partly by the Committee on Security. It's according, at least, information I have.
Bruce, from the political perspective, I mean, what's your analysis of who might be driving this? I mean, as we discussed, like, you know, Nazarbayev is there sitting, you know, having some influential role there, and Tokayev is the president. What I'm trying to understand here is, yes, all these are happening, and it's happening over the past couple of months in some organizations like Human Rights Watch report I referred to earlier. They find it shockingly blunt. So politically speaking, who appears to be benefiting from all these? And that's how I'm kind of trying to understand who might be behind it.
You know, obviously, Yevgeny knows more specifically who's involved. I mean, more generally, all I could say is, you know, you have an entrenched elite there, business elite and a political elite that are there. And they've made themselves quite comfortable in Kazakhstan over the years. And why would they want any change at all? So, you know, they're just trying to neutralize or at least hold at bay as much as possible any potential challenge to their situation as it has been for many years and as it is now.
So you don't distinguish between Nazarbayev and Tokayev here? I mean, both, when you say elite, I mean, I'm just trying to understand, pinpoint the source of this sort of a new development in Kazakhstan. Of course, Kazakhstan has never been an island of democracy, but, you know, they used to do it like not so openly, not so bluntly, the way things were in that country.
Well, you know, again, we can speculate endlessly about what it would be like if Nazarbayev actually didn't have any power at all, and it was all up to Tokayev to figure out what they were going to do. But as it stands right now, you know, he's basically a front man. I mean, Nazarbayev is still effectively president, but he's got this other guy in front out in the public that says that he's the president, even though he seems to be still under orders from Nazarbayev. You know, I mean, I suppose if you're looking for an answer why they can do this bluntly and get away with it, you would probably have to say that they have, you know, they develop ties with other countries that they know are going to back them on this, no matter what they do. China is going to side with Kazakhstan against, you know, Western criticism, and Russia is going to side with Kazakhstan against Western criticism, and there's other countries like that too. You know, so it's not so difficult for whoever's in charge and whoever's giving the orders to understand that there are going to be repercussions from European countries and the United States, but in the meantime, they have solid alliances with these other countries that will side with them if there's problems.
Interesting. Since you mentioned the foreign countries and their role in this, recently European Parliament put out a very blunt statement of its own criticizing the latest crackdown against NGOs in Kazakhstan. So Europeans are usually very diplomatic, but the statement was rather tough, I should say. And Aykerim, last week you spoke to the vice president of European Parliament. How she would explain the language that they used in the statement? And also, what was the reaction by the Kazakh authorities on this statement?
I've spoken to Heidi Hautala. She's the vice president of European Parliament this week. And, well, she didn't really comment about the reaction of Kazakhstani government, which was also, to me at least, it was a bit unusual, because the Ministry of Foreign Affairs specifically, they cited that there might be some inaccuracies in the report or some outdated information, and that they wouldn't take it seriously. And I think that for European Parliament, it was maybe a kind of like turning point that they could no longer keep silent about what's going on in Kazakhstan, because there have been, as we have been talking about it, growing discontent, and there is more information coming from different activists in Kazakhstan, not just through media outlets, but through social media and through different creative protest actions like shaving your head or something like that. And this all, of course, draws attention of different institutions. And as Ms. Hautala said, human rights is not an internal issue of any country, and sometimes European Parliament has to remind countries that a self-confident country will not do what these countries are doing with the human rights situation. So it was, I guess, kind of gentle reminder that it's not okay, and that the world is watching.
If I understand correctly, I agree with your point. So the Kazakh authorities are saying that they are not taking this statement seriously?
They didn't say exactly like that. Maybe I a little bit misinterpreted their words, but they did say that they questioned the accuracy of the data used in the resolution. And to me, it seemed like not so diplomatic. And Kazakh MFA is usually quite diplomatic, I would say. There was also, I think, a strong reaction from Kazakh authorities as well to this resolution.
Marius, so what has been reaction so far on the latest developments in Kazakhstan from other than European Parliament? Anything particularly to note here?
Well, as Yevgeny Alexandrovich mentioned, the U.S. has been outspoken. Honestly, I don't know what else has happened. Of course, international human rights groups have been outspoken.
Right.
But if I could, I would like to just go back to what Bruce mentioned and just chime in with something.
Sure.
Because it's an important case in and of itself, and I think it's also related to what we're talking about. And I think it lends itself very neatly to the discussion surrounding why the authorities were cracking down just now.
Okay.
Because, you know, they're not just going after organizations, but also individuals. And I think this says a lot about what's going on or why it's going on. And I believe the situation surrounding Max Bakayev, you know, the activist and human rights defender who was recently released after serving a prison sentence, basically in retribution for his role in organizing peaceful protests. Well, I believe his imprisonment and maybe just as much the limitations they have now imposed upon his freedom says a lot about how far authorities are willing to go to quench any public protest. They're so determined to stop him from playing any role at all in any kind of protest that Max Bakayev is now not allowed to go where he wants or to participate in any civic or organizational activities, like even charities. And he's not allowed to publish anything or even give statements to the press. Wow. He can't even leave his home after 10 p.m., if I remember correctly.
Wow.
It's as absurd as it is brutal, and I think it clearly underlines the fear authorities have of any and all protest.
Wow, indeed, very, very frightening. Also, since you brought us back to some of the individual cases in human suffering as the consequences of these actions by the authorities, let me also ask this to you, Yevgeny. When you see your colleagues going through such a pressure, I know you have gone through a lot because of your human rights work. I just wondered how you guys handle this.
Of course, what we went through shows that we could not rely on any rule of law. And that's everything was done blatantly and without any kind of following the law. There is nothing at all. It's huge violations of the legal norms and so on. And it's make our organization, some other organizations, because our bureau and some other organization, for example, International Legal Initiative and ECHO organization, which is dealing with the election monitoring. These organizations are well known. And of course, if such well-known, prominent organization with a huge respect in the West are under such straight and strong attack, it shows to the whole civil society. Mm. It has the chilling effect on the whole civil society. And that's, of course, psychologically, it's not good. But again, comparatively looking at the Belarusia, Russia, or Uzbekistan under the Karimov, we understand that at least up to now, we survived. But of course, the wave of events is going in the negative direction because more than 100 criminal cases were opened against the civic activists. And some of them are facing long imprisonment and the trial stuff. Mm. That the situation is really tense.
Yeah, that's tough, Yevgeny. Thank you for sharing that. Just to get back to my initial question, though, about the impact that this renewed pressure is having on your work and work of many other NGOs who are going through this as a human being, how do you guys really cope with the situation? I mean, how do you see your own future, the future of your work? Yes, you know, as you say, Kazakhstan is not yet Belarus, but you also said that things are not yet over. Numerous cases are in the court, you say. So, I mean, you have not yet sailed through this challenging situation. So what I'm saying is, like, are you nervous? Are your family members nervous about what tomorrow might bring upon you? What about the other NGOs? Are they nervous?
I think that everybody are nervous because now we are absolutely the hostages of the political development. And it's absolutely unpredictable. On one hand, we have this growing discontent and we're close to the spring and to the summer when usually the protest activity is much growing. But on another hand, we have these authorities who are very afraid, very scared, and some of their actions are clearly hysterical because it looks like they are cracking down whether they see any potential of some mobilization or consolidation potential. And this is a serious problem. You are, besides anything else, you feel yourself uncomfortable because you couldn't predict anything. You don't know how and when and in what direction this political development will go and how it will influence your organizations, your staff, and your civil society groups.
You know, in your case, for example, Yevgeny, you know, you have this huge reputation, international reputation. There has to be lots of NGOs which are active in local level, smaller ones, like not the type of NGOs that we are talking about, Yevgeny's, but the smaller ones. How they are coping with this pressure, Marius?
Well, obviously, they're highly concerned. But thankfully, the authorities elected to step down, at least for now, because the international attention was just looking to be too costly for their international reputation.
But going forward, what can be done about this? I mean, so that this does not repeat again?
I will jump.
I mean, what is useful? Your sort of message to international committee or anyone who can do anything about the situation. So what they can do about so that this situation not to get repeated.
I think again to keep on pressure and to say the right messages that it will damage the reputation, the image of the country, and their ambitions on different levels of the international relations and economy. If it will be very clear signals, I hope that they will decide that it is too costly for them. If it will be not, there will not enough attention to that, and there will no ongoing pressure and ongoing signaling. I'm not sure that they will not repeat it again, because they are looking at their internal challenges and they are looking how to keep everything under the full control.
Good. It's been a very fascinating conversation. Bruce, is there anything I'm missing? And otherwise, we need to be concluding discussion very soon.
Actually, just one thing real quick, and it's been mentioned that obviously Kazakhstan is watching what's happening in Belarus and Russia,
right,
but
yeah.
And people have mentioned that before, and just to kind of draw that out a little bit more, okay, right, they have similar systems of government, so this has got to be a little bit worrying for people in Kazakhstan, but more than that, these are the three core countries of the Eurasian Economic Union, and they've been hanging together for a long time. So that, when Kazakhstan looks and sees that its two partners in this organization for well over a decade are having these kind of problems, that's got to worry a lot of people in government, and they're probably making a lot of wrong decisions because they're nervous.
Interesting point. If we have to end the conversation here, so where our eyes should be going forward? I mean, where this thing goes in the future? I agree, as a journalist, what will you be watching?
I would watch for the young people because to me it feels like, I'm in their category as well, and I am actually surprised by the level of political activity among my peers, and I feel that they are really interested in political developments in the country, and maybe it's like a new wave of kind of like political activists who want to change the course of the country, and they will find new ways how to put pressure on authorities, and because most of them are educated and they know a lot of different processes that are going on that are related to politics, I think they will be able to convince or educate more people to actively participate, and maybe the future is in the young activists who are getting into these powerful positions as well, maybe not in the government, but in some other areas, and through social, economic projects, they can make a difference.
Okay, on that, Marius, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, now that after a very couple of eventful weeks, authorities sort of slowed down, at least for now, after, I guess, as you rightly mentioned, after international outcry, I guess. So what the future holds? I mean, where your eyes will be?
Well, I certainly agree with what Aygerim said. But I will be watching very closely how authorities relate to civil society groups. Because if authorities had gone through with suspending the activities of these groups, I'm pretty sure they would have gone after other rights groups too, and rather soon. And this, of course, would mean that there would be no one to defend the rights of victims, no one to defend fundamental freedoms at all. And then who would they go after next? Probably the legal profession, my guess. And Kazakhstan has, let's say, challenges in terms of independence of courts, rule of law, and so on. And what checks and balances there are, or I should say probably what protection against injustice there may be in Kazakhstan, is to a large degree provided by civil society. And it would be a very dark scenario indeed for Kazakhstan if authorities were to tear all this away. So that's where my eyes will be.
Interesting. Yevgeny, what about you?
I think I totally agree with Aygerim, because we see clearly growing generational conflict. The growing number of the young generation who are not happy with the elders ruling forever, and that they are growing. There is more and more political involvement, more and more civic activism. But what else I'm witnessing, it's the huge drop in professionalism and competence in state structures. It looks like the huge, let's say, so misconceptionalization, lack of understanding, and so on and so on. And it creates more and more problems in the work of the state apparatus as such. That I think that nearest future will see a lot of developments in different angles, in different different directions, but the driving force to a certain extent will be the youth and this and the growing social discontent and lack of justice, including what Mario said about the judiciary and law enforcement and so on, that we will see. But we are entering certain kind of turmoil and disturbances on that or another level. What authorities are, let's say, afraid of and trying to keep control and crack down exactly on what they should not do, because in reality the civil society is the decision and not the problem.
Interesting. These are, you know, some of the very interesting signs of tipping points. Bruce, you know, we were talking about the possible social discontent. I mean, you know, after long period of, you know, COVID-19 situation in every country is going through some of the worst economic setbacks. In Kazakhstan, certainly is not immune. So sources of those social discontent, I guess, is there to stay. So where your eyes will be going forward as to where we are headed after this stage?
Well, you know, I was struck when Yevgeny talked about the fact that spring and summer are coming up, and of course this is protest time. And so that's really all the further I'm going to be looking, is what's going to happen when the weather gets warmer, when people start to get vaccinated and they can move around out on the outside more safely. And will that bring a lot more rallies, protests, demonstrations? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's an approved rally in Almaty for Women's Day on March 8th. So I'll be watching that to see if that turns political as well as being a march in support of women. But that might only be the first of many, many kind of rallies, sanctioned, unsanctioned, to follow once, you know, people have been cooped up for a long time. And you see, it's not just Kazakhstan, but all over the world, that when they get a chance to get out, a lot of times things get pretty crazy pretty quick.
Right.
You know, the United States, certainly. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens when people feel safe in terms of health care, and also the weather's warmer, and they get a little bolder and decide they're tired of being at home and they want to get out, and they've had enough of the system, and you know, everything kind of combines for demonstrations, protests in the coming months.
Right. Okay.
Could I just
very briefly, Marius, yes.
Could I just add to that that there is an approved demonstration against corruption in Uralsk on February 28th as well, which will be interesting to follow.
Interesting. When we talk about Kazakhstan in these terms, we end up speaking about mostly Almaty and Astana. But that's interesting with the point that you brought in, Marius. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. With this, we have to conclude the discussion here. So Marius Fossum, regional representative in Central Asia for the Norwegian Helsinki Committee, thank you very much for joining us. And also big thanks goes to Yevgeny Zhovtis, the director of the Kazakhstan International Bureau for Human Rights and Rule of Law, Aygrim Tolyukhanova, senior Kazakh journalist with Radio Free Europe Liberties Kazakh Service, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe Liberties Central Asia blog, Kishlak Owazi. Thank you again, colleagues, for joining us today. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe Liberties media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.